sports, politics, life, Buck Roofing presents Kevin Keatsman Has Issues.
We got a very busy Monday for you, as promised, a podcast number two on this Monday. In just a few minutes, Ryan LaFever will join us. We'll talk about, some really fun stuff, some childhood memories he had growing up in Los Angeles. That's where the Royals are, playing the Angels. Of course, Ryan's dad was with the Dodgers and then the Giants. He's got some history from a game at the Angels. A lot of things California related. I'm even going to share a couple of my stories from being in California or seeing the Royals play then the California Angels. So stay tuned for that. We've got some good baseball stories coming up. We're not going to lock too much in and focus on this year's Royals too much, although they're winding up the road trip after winning 2 out of 3 this weekend. Ryan will be with us in just a few minutes. Fascinating discussion today about many of his experiences, including, get this, when he was almost kicked out of a Major League Baseball game as a 9-year-old bat boy. Great story. Stay tuned for all of that. A couple of things in the news today. We did a patron podcast on this Monday afternoon. If you want to become a patron, you can go to kkhasissues.com and get signed up. I did the full Monty on Eric Greitens' new campaign ad. If you haven't seen it, it is unbelievable. We'll address it maybe a little bit on Tuesday, but everybody's going to be talking about this ad. And immediately, his former wife has grabbed the ad and entered it into court in their dispute over their children because she claims that he is violent. Of course, the ad is violent. It's him and Navy SEALs breaking into a home to kill rhinos. Republicans in names only. Says go get a permit to hunt rhinos. It is wild, folks. Wild. And Daily Caller has put out a story on this Monday about Sharice Davids in District 3 of Kansas, who is for, apparently, a congressional legislative movement that Congress, members of Congress, can't buy and sell stocks on the stock market. But according to Daily Caller, she owns all kinds of stocks, thousands of dollars worth of stocks, in green energy companies that she works with and Democrats benefit from. So how about that? I mean, aren't we all really surprised that Sharice Davids would be like that? So plenty going on over at the Patreon podcast. You want to catch all that. It's a good long one today at kkhasissues.com if you want to get signed up. And, of course, you get the newsletter each and every week as well. I say this is part B of the podcast from earlier today. If you listened to the first Monday podcast, and that's the one with the headline of Joe Biden's bicycle fall being a metaphor for the White House. So if you see that headline, it's that podcast. But toward the end, we talked about Clay Travis, who was with OutKick and is a Fox News contributor and all these other things, because recently he went to a Little League game and got kicked out for F-bombing the umpire. I wrote about that in the Patreon post, and I talked about it, read a chunk of that, and talked about it on the earlier podcast on Monday, and I referenced that I had an email that I was going to share with you, because I got many emails from patrons about the post this weekend. And I don't think I included it. I got done with the podcast. I'm like, I think I spaced that off. And I looked around. I got this email from Bill. And I'm looking around, and I can't find it anywhere in my stack. I'm like, what did I do? I couldn't have possibly read. Sometimes you don't remember what you've exactly just said in the previous hour while doing a podcast. But I couldn't find the thing. And it was buried at the bottom of the stack when I finally found it. I'm like, well, there's no way I read that. I know I didn't, because I didn't remember reading it. And then, of course, I couldn't find it, which means I didn't just have it in my hand. But I do have it in my hand right now. After we talked about Clay Travis and the man in New Jersey who attacked an umpire and the problem with parents at Little League games, not understanding that the rest of the world cannot identify with them, and it's not a good look for Clay Travis to be out there bashing Chuck Schumer because he's inciting people to go get in front of Supreme Court justices and do things, while at the same time, Clay Travis is verbally abusing and bullying umpires and likely, unbeknownst to him, he didn't do it on purpose, likely empowering and inciting parents all over the country that think he's great, that it's okay to do to an umpire what he did. And then to just out them publicly, whether that's on Facebook or you have a platform with millions of people, doesn't matter. It's not the right thing to do. So we addressed that, but I forgot to read the email. I just thought this one really summed it up. So I want to share it from you. This is from Bill. And he sent it Friday after I put the patron post up. Awesome post today, Kevin. You're absolutely right about Clay Travis. He is most certainly going to do something stupid to make all us conservatives look bad. It's obvious he's never played a sport in his life because berating an official never gets you a call. Everyone that plays sports knows this. I've played baseball my whole life, and I still play and coach to this day. I teach my boys to talk respectfully to the umpires and to even joke around with them and to have fun with them. When they're relaxed and having fun, they become better umpires and officials. Plus, most of these people are kids, and a lot of the umpires are very young, almost kid-like. Anyway, if you're nice and you're respectful, you're going to get more calls. Jackasses never get calls. Thanks, Bill. And I didn't ask him if I could use his full name there, but he's exactly right, and he clearly has that experience, and I think we all know that. And I started to think back when I played, and I was jovial. I poked a stick at the players I played against. When they were out on second base, I was playing shortstop, I'd get on them pretty good. And I'd chatter from the dugout. It would always be directed at the guys on the team. As we got older, we knew a lot of the players on the other teams. They were tired of hearing it from me, but it wasn't F-bombs. It wasn't awful. It was just, this is part of the deal. Letting you know we're over here, and we're pretty good, by the way. We reminded them at every corner how good we are. You know, when you play doubleheaders and you've won the first game 10-2, it's pretty easy to remind them how good you are. And so we did that. Never thought that was a problem. We called it chatter back then. But we always had fun with the umpires and joked around with them. I never stood at the plate and argued a called third strike or any kind of a strike or got mad at an umpire at any point. We just didn't do it. But now the parents are showing the way to do this. And we know it's a problem around the country. I just think it's a worse problem when it's a public figure. I thought that I want to stay steady with what I was. I thought Mark Mangino and the stunt that he pulled when he was a KU coach to a high school official was completely Bush League. And the same thing stands with Clay Travis. I have a former coworker that got in trouble, you know, way back in the day at a game. He played in a slow pitch softball league or something and berated a guy, and word got all over town. And he addressed it, and it's the silliest thing ever. So it is what it is, but I want to thank all of you for emailing and saying you're right, and we are worried about Clay Travis for saying something or doing something that's going to make us look bad. You just can kind of tell when you watch him and listen to him that, I don't know, sometimes I feel like I see some people and think, I'm not sure I really want that person on my team. A lot of times it's people to the left. I mean, you look at Mitt Romney, we've all made the decision, if you're a conservative, you've made the decision on Mitt Romney, you don't really want him on your team. So we know some of these people, right? And we see Kinzinger and whatnot in this select committee. You don't want them on your team. They get voted out. The ones you worry about are, well, what's the guy they all really hate? I don't read his stuff. Alex Jones? I don't follow InfoWars. Yeah, it's InfoWars. I really don't go there or follow him because I just can't. And I'm just afraid that's just a leap too far. And I get worried about people that use their platform to harm others for personal reasons. You made a call against my kid. I F-bombed you. Like three things happened. The kid did something. It was just a call. He didn't get kicked out of the game. The umpire enforced a rule that he probably shouldn't have enforced. Dad gets mad in the stands, F-bombs the umpire. Umpire kicks man out. Man goes to his podcast and website where he has millions of followers and just abuses this dude. None of it's any good. None of it makes any sense. Just not everyone on the team is always a great teammate. I'm just trying to help you sort it out a little bit. That's all I'm trying to do. I'll tell you some great teammates. Fry Orthodontics, always proud to sponsor Ryan LaFever on KKHI. If you're not proud to sponsor Ryan LaFever, one of the finest human beings you will ever meet, then I don't know what you'd be proud of, but Fry Orthodontics certainly is. And here's the deal. Fry Orthodontics sponsoring Ryan LaFever segment is probably pretty smart because Ryan has so many children. I mean, there's got to be some business in this for Dr. Jeremy. There's no way these kids are all going to have perfect teeth. That's just too many kids to all have perfect teeth. So maybe that's it. Maybe he knows he's got a house full of kids. They'll be entering the braces and Invisalign stage soon. I'm just kidding. Jeremy is a huge Royals fan and loves sponsoring some of our baseball content right here at KKHI. We have three main sponsors, Fry Orthodontics, who I just mentioned, AmazingGarageFloors.net, John Hutchins, such a big fan. He went to fantasy camp last year, Royals fantasy camp. I mean, he's not only an Air Force patriot and a great American, he loves baseball and loves the Royals. He supports redwhiteandbluma.org each September, raising money for military charities in Kansas City. It's amazing, garagefloors.net. And, of course, my guy TJ at Back 9 Development, also a big Royals fan. Check out the Solheim Condominiums at Grand Mere online at back9development.com. I stayed at my friend's condo at Grand Mere in Manhattan on the Colbert Hills Golf Course. You walk right up to the clubhouse. You're right there. It's a really, really special condo community. We went to the pool. We did it all this weekend. It was great. Big, spacious hallways and apartments, quality built, high end. Spent time out on the deck overlooking the Flint Hills. Beautiful. It's back9development.com, the Solheim Condominiums at Grand Mere. And TJ is obviously proud to be a sponsor of Ryan LaFever's appearance on KKHI. Hit it!
The KK Has Issues conversation is presented by Joslyn's Jewelry, 95th and Antioch, or online at joslynsjewelry.com.
Ryan LaFever joins us now, and he is in his hometown. Well, not Anaheim, but the Los Angeles area where he spent so much time as a child, and in California, watching his dad play and later manage and all the different things that come with being in a major league household, the Royals taking on the Angels beginning Monday night. Ryan, how are you, sir? It's old home week in California. You've been there a while, buddy.
I know. Good to talk to you, Kevin. It was a strange beginning to this trip because we spent 1 week in the same city. And if you count my first job, this is 28 years for me, and I've never been in the same hotel for 1 week, but that's what we did in the Bay Area.
I was going to ask, did you stay in the same place? And since you did it get boring staying in the same hotel? Would you have liked to have broken it up and switched when you went to Oakland?
We'd laughed amongst each other because on one hand, we complain about the grind of the season and the games just keep coming and we're traveling all the time. But then you take the grind away for a week, and it just felt awkward that we weren't moving on to the next location. But we did stay in the same hotel. We always stay in San Francisco, even if we're playing Oakland. So we played the Giants for three. We had a day off Thursday and then played the A's for three and never left the same hotel. It was a great trip for getting out and seeing the city because we had a day game Wednesday, so everyone was able to go out. A day game Thursday, and then we had a day game Saturday. So there was plenty of time to explore the city. And so it was fun to just catch up with members of the broadcast team and go out and have some dinner. But I will say waking up in the same hotel for 6-7 days in a row was very odd.
Well, you'll take it, I guess. So before we get into some history and some stories that we both have from California, because I've got a couple as well, let's just briefly touch here on the team. The pitching's been better. Looking pretty good. They get 2 out of 3 against the A's. The hitting not so good on Sunday, but all in all, you win a series. Pretty good. They're not really. Yesterday they played like 5 guys that are over 30. Where are the Royals right now, and how would you describe exactly what they're trying to do?
Well, I think they're trying to win games, and I know that sounds very elementary, but I go back to Dayton Moore's comments during his very first trading line in 2006, trading deadline. And he said, every win at the major league level is important. And, you know, there have been trading deadlines that have come and gone, and we expected Dayton to trade away a veteran. And especially in the early years when he was here and we didn't seem to be going anywhere, it was just exciting to think about a young player coming into the organization and maybe, you know, you catch lightning in a bottle and it works out for the Royals. But if Dayton's not going to get anything in return that's going to help the team significantly, he's not just going to give away veterans for, you know, the sake of giving away veterans. And he just believes that even if you're mathematically eliminated or you're out of it, whatever, that every win means something to the next game and the next month and the next year or whatever. So that's a kind of a winding way to answer your question that I think Mike Matheny is trying to find the right matchups to win games. And I'm sure at the same time, there's interest in Royals veterans. And so it doesn't hurt that if another team or teams is interested in making a deal that could help the Royals in the future, you always want to put those guys out there on display for the other teams to see. But the longer I've been here and the longer Dayton's been here, I've really taken that to heart, that no matter what the Royals situation is, no matter what the roster looks like right now, just do everything you can to win a game, because that has a ripple effect into the future.
You know, I feel like in other sports, a lot of times we talk about results in games, not necessarily the outcome, the score, but just the results, way games are played, the way individual players play, are opponent-driven many times. We do this in football all the time. We say, okay, wow, you're going up against the number one defense in the league this week. You're probably not going to score 35 points or something like that. As you watch a long baseball season, I mean a really long season, 162 games, as you see almost every single pitch the Royals have, hitters and pitchers, how often, because they go good and bad, they go hot and cold, and we clearly know players get in slumps where it doesn't matter who they're facing, if they're in the plate, they're not going well right now. How much of this is opponent-driven? In other words, if the Royals are pitching better, do we look at the A's and go, okay, well, they're playing the A's or something like that? How much of baseball is opponent-driven, and how much of it is you're either just hot or cold?
Well, as you're talking, I'm thinking that baseball is still the only sport where the head coach is called the manager. And I do believe that that's fitting, because in a sport that's played every single day, I mean, Andy Reid, unless you're right on the edge of the playoffs, I mean, he's never going to say, you know, Patrick Mahomes is looking a little worn out, we're just going to give him this Sunday off, right?
Right.
And in the NBA and the NHL, that's extremely rare. But in baseball, a manager with the games played every day, and in the summer months now, we're starting to warm up, and it's going to be warm here in Anaheim, not quite as hot as it is in Kansas City. But that's something that the manager always has to keep an eye on. And so, to your point about the opponent, they're always looking 2, 3, 4 games ahead and thinking, okay, when is this guy going to need a break? Oh boy, here's a tough lefty. He's had a bad time with him in the past. Let's set this up so that he gets Wednesday off or whatever when we're facing this pitcher. Or you might have relievers who traditionally have had success against certain hitters in a lineup or haven't, and you're going to make your decisions, you know, based on the opponent. I mean, I don't know if there's a sport that spends more time on individual matchups as baseball does. I mean, you've got your team matchups, obviously, but you don't really hear the word scheme very often in baseball like you might hear in football or even in basketball when it comes to defense and offense. I mean, it really is a team sport that comes down to the individual matchups, and it's the job of the manager and the coaches to manage when is the best time to give a player a break. Or, you know, conversely, haven't you seen, I know I have, you wonder why a guy's in the lineup in certain games and you look down and he has great numbers against this pitcher, or he used to play for that team. Mm-hmm. I see that a lot. You know, let's get this guy in the lineup. This is his former team. He's going to have some extra motivation against this team. Let's ride that. So it's a strange title to be called a manager, but that's really what they're doing most of the time. It's just managing all that playing time and all the opponents that are just coming one after another.
All right, so the Angels are up next, and this is going to lead us down the road of a lot of stories that you have as a kid. And I'm not going to tell my stories. I'm just going to give very short little one-paragraph statements on my two stories to share with you. One I shared before we started recording the podcast. That was in 1985. The final week of the season, the Royals were one game down to the Angels with a week to go. And on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, they played the Angels at Kauffman Stadium. And me and my buddy Cato were seniors in college at K-State. And we drove back for each game each night, went to all four of them, sat in the bleachers, never told our parents. Nobody knew what we were doing. We just did it every day because we had to. We had a dog. We got a puppy that fall. We got a puppy from the pound and named it Sabes. And we had a roommate that took care of Sabes while we were gone every night, which was nice. So that was kind of cool. My other Angels story that was fun was when George Brett was going for 3,000 hits, Channel 4 sent me to Los Angeles to do a story on where George Brett is from. El Segundo High, talked to his coach, did all these different things, shot his childhood home. We got all this video. Buddy, they sent us for one night. We took the early flight out. We shot stuff all day. We went to a game that night. The next day, we went and shot some more stuff, got on a plane, and flew home. I don't think he got his 3,000th hit for a couple days later. We were all doing advanced stories. They were so cheap, they didn't let us stay, Ryan. We got to go for a day and do all this advanced stuff, and they said, he's going to get a hit at 11:45 at night, and nobody's going to see it. We'll have the footage anyway, so get your butt back home. I was never so disappointed.
Well, to your first one, were those games televised, or was that back when the Royals didn't televise most of their home games?
Yeah, if there was, there might have been one. No, they were all home games. None of those would have been on at all. There couldn't have been, I went to work at Channel 4. I interned for Channel 4 that summer, and they had the games, and I want to say it was a 30-game package. It was 30 of the 30 of the 81 road games were on TV, and that was it. Denny Treese was the play-by-play guy then. Imagine how good a job that would be. 30 games, Ryan, that's it.
Well, I would have lost income if the schedule was like that back then, but there's just something romantic about, hey, look, if you want to cheer on your team here and you want to watch him, you need to go, and that you'd have college kids driving from Manhattan after class and then going back home.
Yeah.
Late at night afterwards, going to class and turning around and doing it again.
Yeah, well, we really felt our parents would be mad if they knew that we were doing that each day. What are you spending the money for, buying gas? So, or we could have stayed at home. We clearly could have spent the night and gone back in the morning or whatever. But you know what? I remember teasing Denny Treese. Actually, I remember Frank Bohl teasing Denny Treese about how much money he made for only doing 30 games a year. It was a salaried position, and I think it was a pretty good salary. And they asked him to try to do stuff in the off season. And he didn't like it doing it. You know, they wanted him to come in and do like a Royals feature once a week. And he's like, I'm the play-by-play guy. I'm not coming into the news department and doing a Royals feature. That literally was the job. I mean, he did 30 games, and then I think he did some college basketball in the offseason.
And that's probably what a lot of other guys were doing. Although in that time, you're old enough to remember, but I'm guessing a lot of people don't. But in those days, radio and TV would bounce back and forth, and not like we do it today where Steve Fizziak and I will cross over radio and television. But I came in at the tail end in the mid 90s with the Twins, where we would do radio and television in the same game and do the first three innings on radio, go over to TV for the middle three innings, and then back to radio again for the last three innings. And so that's how they started to break in television announcers. It was radio guys going and doing some television. But Denny Treese was the first of a wave during that time when the games got to 30, because that was probably a big number at the time, but yeah, the games got to 30 and said, you know, we probably need to go out and hire a separate television announcer for these.
And that's what he did. Okay, let's talk about, you didn't go to the Angels games much as a kid. What part of Los Angeles did you grow up in? And you spent most of your time at Dodger Stadium, correct?
Yeah. So I lived on the far west side. I was mostly in the Santa Monica area. So I was a beach kid, and Orange County was like another state. I mean, you really didn't go to Orange County unless you were going to Disneyland or maybe go watch the Angels or the Rams, you know, played at the, when they moved out of the Coliseum, they played at in Anaheim when they turned the baseball stadium into one of those cookie cutters, multi-purpose stadiums. But other than that, I mean, it really, there was no reason to go to Orange County. I mean, it was like a vacation, even though it really wasn't that far away. But I do have I have two memories in particular, one personal and one professional. But my dad was the manager of the Mariners when Ken Griffey and Ken Griffey Jr. were on the same team. And in Seattle, when Ken Griffey Sr. made his debut, I was sitting next to my dad when they got back-to-back base hits against the Royals of all teams. And I was sitting right next to my dad. And I may have shared this story with you before, but in the Kingdom, the on-deck circle was right in front of the dugout. I mean, it was right there. And I heard something that I'm pretty sure has never been uttered before and never will be uttered again in a Major League Baseball game. And that was the on-deck hitter saying to the batter, "Come on, Dad." I heard that. And I remember, I mean, I remember thinking, even as a, you know, knucklehead, 19 years old, 20 years old, whatever I was at that time, thinking that was pretty special.
Yeah.
And they ended up getting back-to-back hits. But to your point, later in that year, I got home for the summer. So I was back in LA and the Mariners were in Anaheim. And so I drove over to spend some time with my dad. And I was in the dugout when they hit back-to-back home runs against Kirk McCaskill in Anaheim. And if you go look it up on YouTube and you go frame by frame, I'm one of the guys in uniform, you know, getting in the middle of the high fives. And I watch that now and I just cover my eyes and go, what are you doing? You don't belong in there. You should just be sitting on the dugout bench where you should be. But, you know, I got myself right in the middle of the congratulations on the back-to-back home runs.
How could you
not? So that was the personal. I probably got caught up in the moment. And and then the professional one, obviously, was 2014 when we won that crazy wild card game. And many people thought, well, that was the end of it. That was a neat story, that come from behind. The Royals are back in the postseason. And now we come out here and face a team that had won, I think, 96 games, 98 games, something like that. And they had Albert Pujols and they had Josh Hamilton. And, you know, there was no chance for the Royals to advance. And we come out here and two staples of Dayton Moore's rebuild hit huge home runs to win the two games here. Mike Moustakas in game one and Eric Hosmer in game two. And we were back to Kansas City and away we go. And it's funny we're talking right now, Kevin, because here are the four teams we're playing in a row. Baltimore at home, San Francisco on the road, Oakland on the road, Anaheim on the road.
There it is.
Those are the four playoff teams from 2014.
Wow.
So Dave Holtzman's been calling this the 2014 victory tour.
That's so fun. And those were obviously such great times. You know, I can't imagine, you mentioned Kirk McCaskill giving up those home runs. You've been around a lot of ex-players as well as they get older. So a guy like that, and I assume he's still alive. I don't know. If you were just like hanging out, having brunch with the dude at this point, would he be glad that that happened in his career, that there was some sort of part of history that the Griffies hit back-to-back home runs off him? Or is that something the rest of your life you want to hide from? I've always wondered that with pitchers.
I would think it'd be something you'd embrace over time. When we were living in Los Angeles and my mom and dad were still married, she became friendly with the other wives and some of the players. And one of the players she was most friendly with was Al Downing, who gave up Hank Aaron's 715th home run in Atlanta. And he embraced that over time. I think the most famous one was Ralph Branca, who gave up the home run to Bobby Thompson when the famous call, "The Giants win the pennant, the Giants win the pennant," the Russ Hodges call. Over time, they became friends and they would tour together. And Ralph Branca very humbly embraced that, and they would do autograph shows together, or they would speak together and talk about that iconic moment. And he really embraced that. So I think over time, I don't think a pitcher wants to stand on the mound where this huge celebration is going on, you know, because of something that a hitter did against them. But I think over time, it's a way to be remembered and to just realize the significance of that historic moment.
All right, so you spent a lot of time as a Dodger fan growing up, and then all of a sudden you had to become a Giants fan. And at one point you were a bat boy and almost got in some trouble. Which one do you want to start with? Transitioning from the Dodgers to the Giants or the bat boy story?
Yeah, let's start with the transition. Okay. So, I mean, basically, my favorite team was whatever team my dad was coaching for or managing for. I was too young to really remember him as a player, but growing up in Los Angeles in the 70s and with the name LeFever, I mean, it's a hard name to hide from, and Dodger fans were, you know, well aware of my dad. And then he comes back as a coach in 78 and in 79. So now I'm a Dodger fan, just like all of my friends and all of my neighbors. But then he goes to the Giants and becomes their hitting coach. And I learned very quickly that if I was going to be a Giants fan, I had to hate the Dodgers. And in 1979, I was 8 years old, and I had this glove, this old glove that I would take to the ballpark with me. And Ken Brett and Jerry Royce were left-hand pitchers for the Dodgers. And they asked me one day, both of them in different days, "Hey, would you use this glove? It's a brand new glove. You can help me break it in." I think, I don't know if they really thought an 8-year olds could break in a major leaguer's glove, but Ken Brett let me use a glove. And then Jerry Royce said, "Well, here, you break in my glove." So on alternating days, I would use Ken Brett's glove and then Jerry Royce's glove. And then about a week or two later, I come to the ballpark and they had gone to their Rawlings representative and they gave me my first real glove.
Wow.
Ken Brett and Jerry Royce. So I've always said, even in Kansas City, you know, when I would, and I've told George this, when I think of Brett, I think of his late brother Ken, who gave me my first glove. So the next year, my dad's with the Giants. And my first game was in 1980, so now I'm 9. And back then, you know, little kids could be bat boys. So it's my first game at Candlestick Park. The Dodgers are in town, and now the hated Dodgers. And Jerry Royce is pitching. So here's a gentleman who just gave me my first glove the year before. And I've never seen anything like this in my life. I mean, there were fights in the stands, people running on the field, burning Dodger jerseys and pennants and throw. I mean, it was crazy, and it was frightening and exciting at the same time. You can imagine watching all this. And Jerry Royce throws a no-hitter. And so you talk about being tormented. You know, here are my heroes for most of my childhood. Now I'm rooting against him, and I'm rooting for my dad's team only because I just wanted my dad's team to win. And he's no-hit by my heroes. So that was quite an introduction to the Dodgers and Giants rivalry. But the one you're talking about where I was getting in trouble was actually a funny story. I think it was a year later, maybe 2 years later, and Frank Robinson, the Hall of Famer, had become manager of the Giants. Dodger Stadium has this long dugout. I mean, even for that time, just this incredibly long dugout. On the home plate side of the dugout, on the first base side, the visitor's dugout, on the home plate side, behind the dugout is the tunnel that goes up to the clubhouse. And as a bat boy, I would be kneeling in front of that part of the dugout because it was near the bat rack and it was the closest route to home plate to get bats or foul balls up against the screen. Dodger Stadium was a kind of a long jog out to home plate from the dugout. That's just to kind of set the stage. Rich Gale, who also pitched for the Royals, Rich Gale was pitching for the Giants. And he thought he was getting squeezed by the home plate umpire, who was a young Ed Montague. And the only reason I know this is because I figured out the dates years ago, and I went to Baseball Reference to figure out who the characters were in this story.
Awesome.
So Rich Gale feels like he's getting squeezed. The dugout feels like he's getting squeezed. And they're yelling at Ed Montague. And since it's so far away from home plate, Ed Montague would look into the dugout, but everyone was just this black and orange blur. He really couldn't tell, you know, who was saying what. So the inning's over. Gale comes off the mound. He sits down. He's still complaining. And he walks from the bench to that tunnel that's behind the dugout. Mm-hmm. So he's right behind me. And the first pitch to a Giants batter is a borderline pitch. And Ed Montague calls it a strike. And the dugout is just chewing on Ed Montague again. And so Ed Montague looks over and Rich Gale hurls some obscenity from behind me. And Ed Montague takes his mask off and says, "You're out of here." And so Rich Gale then realizes, you know, he just got thrown out of the game. So in order to save himself, he goes up the tunnel to the clubhouse. Frank Robinson explodes. He comes running out of the dugout and says, "Who's out of here?" And he says, "Gale. Gale's out of here. I heard him." And he turns around and says, "Gale's not even in the dugout. He's up in the clubhouse. You can't throw him out." They're arguing, Kevin, like 10 feet in front of me. And this is 50,000 people at Dodger Stadium. And this is the Dodgers and the Giants. So it's a madhouse again, booing and yelling. And this is all going on right in front of me. And I'm 9 or 10 years old. And they're yelling and screaming. And Ed Montague saying, "It was Gale. I heard Gale." And Frank saying, he's not even in the dugout. And finally, Ed Montague had to realize that maybe it wasn't Rich Gale. And if he threw him out, then he's losing his starting pitcher. And Ed Montague says, "I saw somebody standing right there, and it came from right there." And he pointed at me. And Frank Robinson, in this heated moment, all of a sudden, here comes his sense of humor. And I'll leave the expletive out. But he looks at me and he goes, "Well, bleep, Ryan, you heard the man.
You're gone."
And Ed Montague kind of laughs and he's frustrated at the same time. He says, "No, not the kid. Somebody's got to go, Frank." And I can't remember who ended up having to be the sacrificial lamb that, you know, had to leave the dugout and be ejected. But for a moment there, Frank Robinson tried to have me thrown out of a game, claiming that I was the one that was hurling all the insults at Ed Montague. Good.
And of course, that was... the easy choice is the starting pitcher the night before. That's the one you kick out, right? You don't need him for four more
days. And it was somebody like that. Yeah, it was somebody like that.
Were you scared at that moment? Did you think, I may really have to go? I mean, did you feel like you were in this and you may get kicked out and embarrassed in front of all these people?
It took my breath away because I didn't know what that meant. And I didn't realize at the moment that Frank was just joking. I thought that, you know, I thought I was going to be in trouble. You know, I mean, you can imagine 50,000 people. I mean, this place was going to turn into a riot in just a matter of moments. And all of a sudden, Ed Montague points at me, and I knew what he was saying because Rich Gale had said that right behind me. But when Frank said, all right, you know, well, bleep, Ryan, you heard the man. And I mean, it took my breath away. And then Ed Montague said, realize, no, not the kid. It's got to be somebody else. And so there you go.
So how did all this start between the Dodgers and the Giants? You talk about the fans and, you know, we've seen some incidents the last few years. Fans will get into it. We've had some crimes committed and some really bad ones. The most anger I've ever felt at a baseball game was many years ago. Jessica and I were at Fenway Park for a Yankees Red Sox game, and they walk around in t-shirts that say, take your 27 rings and shove them up your blanking blank. And they just wear them like just right out in front of Yankee fans who come in there with these fake plastic rings all over their fingers. You know, it's unbelievable. And they hurl insults and curse at each other and toss beer on one another. We never saw a fight or anything bad like that, but it was a blood sport. I mean, Yankees Red Sox was unbelievable. It sounds like maybe this is even a higher level than that. How did the Dodgers and Giants become this?
Well, it goes back to New York, and they moved out there at the same time in 1958. And when they did, they were the only teams west of St. Louis. So you have two cities. I'm sure there was a rivalry before that because, you know, during that time, you're talking about two port cities that were probably competing for imports and exports because they're right on the ocean. So I imagine there was some sort of rivalry prior to that. Now they have rival baseball teams fighting for fans. And I think it just started from there. And I don't think it's gotten any better. I mean, I think there's more crowd control now than there was there because, I mean, you had a whole section of people that would be fighting. And I think with social media now and camera phones, I think people are more reluctant now to, you know, that they can be in trouble by way of a short video on somebody's phone. But I mean, it was brutal back then. I mean, I mean brutal. I mean, starting things mm-hmm. on fire and people running on the field and brawls in the stands. And that was in both stadiums. It wasn't just in one or the other.
So would you say Los Angeles like right now is 2-1 Dodger fans? And what do players that you've known through the years, what do they say about playing on one of these teams, you know, the Mets, the White Sox, the Angels, that's kind of second fiddle in their major city?
You know, it's such a big city that it's possible, and it's happened for years, that both of them can draw 3 million fans.
Yeah.
And Orange County has really grown. That was almost impossible when I was a kid here. I mean, the Angels were well below the Dodgers. And I think that's still the case now, but there's enough population in Orange County. And the Angels, while they, you know, they haven't gone very far as the playoffs go over the last 20 years, you know, they won the World Series 20 years ago, and they're going to honor that team while we're here for this series. But you know, they were good winning divisions for a long time, and then, you know, they have marquee players like Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani, so they have their own draw. But I think you know, it's very similar to mid-Missouri when you're talking about Royals and Cardinals. You know, even if the Royals are doing well, you know, you're going up against generations of tradition of rooting for the Cardinals, and so you really have to do something out of the ordinary to get people to leave one team and go to the other. And I think that's the case here. I think you have a lot of Dodgers fans that are stuck in Orange County though. And the traffic is so bad here that, you know, even just driving to Los Angeles is a mess. So just because of proximity, I think you might have a lot of fans that go watch the Angels. And then over time they begin to follow the Angels.
So have you seen this dust up about the fantasy football league that Mike Trout was commissioner of?
Yeah, I did. In fact, I couldn't, every time Jack Peterson came to the plate during that Giants series, as accomplished as he is as a player, that's all I could think about, were his just innocent but brutally honest answers to, you know, why he had that incident with Tommy Pham.
And Mike Trout was the commissioner of the league, and he said on Sunday Night Baseball a week ago, 8 days ago from when we're recording this, he said, I'm not going to be commissioner anymore, but everybody in the league is now calling him wanting in the fantasy league. Do we know if a Royals player was? He said Alex Bregman won the thing. And then the ESPN announcers didn't ask how much he won. I'm dying to know what they were playing for and how much Alex Bregman won. And were there any Royals in it? Do we know if there was a Royal in this league?
I don't know. And I haven't asked. Uh-huh. I probably won't ask. But it was an enormous amount of money, wasn't it?
I didn't hear the money.
I think in the early stages of this, they had mentioned I think it was at least $50,000. I think no, maybe it was $50,000 to get into it, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was thinking if they had a 16 person league and they were all in for like $100,000, the winner could win $1 million. That would be them would be fighting words.
Isn't it how America is that though? That there's this fantasy league that nobody knows about until two guys fight over it, mm-hmm. and then other guys say, "Hey, I want a piece of that."
Right. And they don't fight over it until 6 months later. That's the best part. They hadn't seen each other. So which Royal would be most likely to be in it? I mean, Salvador Perez, he knows everybody, but he doesn't strike me as really a fantasy football guy. Whit Merrifield strikes me as a fantasy football guy, but I don't know if he would toss his money around like that. You know these. If there were one Royal most likely to be in Mike Trout's fantasy football league, who would it be?
Oh, boy. You know, I don't know, and it's because of the last 2 years, just not traveling with these guys and not being around them in 20 and 21. But I can say before that, it was Billy Butler. Billy Butler was huge fantasy baseball. And when we would be on the plane, Dave Holtzman, who was, you know, an employee of the Royals before he joined us on the television team, he was the commissioner. And he and I sit next to each other on the plane. And so we would be flying into wherever, Cleveland or Detroit. And if we got in at a decent hour, they would have their draft and they would rent out a conference room in the hotel. And it was serious stuff. I mean, it was annoying after a while, to be honest, because the days leading up to it on the plane, I mean, everybody would come by Holtzy and ask him about this rule or can we do this? Or, hey, did you get our check? Because so-and-so and I are going to be on a team and all that. So I've lost touch with that. But I was right by accident, just because I would sit next to Holtzy. I was right in the middle of all that for a couple of years. And Billy Butler, by far, was most interested in fantasy football.
Well, I think they should turn this. I said this last week on a podcast. Nobody's going to hear me say this. But I think they should turn this into a major positive for Major League Baseball. I think if Mike Trout isn't the commissioner or there's someone else, they ought to auction off to some rich guy who has more money than he knows what to do with for $1 million to charity. We will let you in our league. They should just find one rich fan out there that's willing to write a check for $1 million straight to the charity and say, we'll let you in our fantasy football league this year. They could turn this whole thing into something good.
That's a great idea. And it'll be your idea.
Well,
and how do we get the word out?
Yeah, Mike Trout would look at me
let's
and go,
find the charity.
Well, yeah, you know what? If they got a guy that rich coming in willing to just give $1 million to charity to jump in, then maybe that's kind of the sucker they want in their league anyway.
Well, it's getting plenty of publicity. I'm sure there's plenty of people out there that would jump on that if they made an opening for somebody like that.
I think it's great. And I thought his interview was great live during the game. He was DHing that night. But we've seen Votto earlier this year over at first base mic'd up on ESPN. They're doing a lot more of this. I know you've done it and had it done during in spring training and things like that. I think it really humanizes a lot of these baseball players, some of the stuff I'm seeing. Do you kind of sense that maybe is coming and changing with your broadcast, live interviews, mic'd up players, things like that? What do you think that does for the game, and how much would you like to see in your broadcast like that?
Well, I would love that. Even talking to the coaches and the manager, that can be a little more challenging because they have to be into the game and every pitch more than the players do. But it's such a unique sport where there are players who are available to talk that are not worried about being thrust into the game. I mean, you can't do that in any other sport because you never know if the coach is going to say, hey, you're in the game. We had a close call in spring training last year in 21 and going back on the air and Mike Matheny recognizing, you know, how much had been lost by the shortened 2020 season. He said, hey, during our first radio broadcast, hey, who do you want on the air? I'll help you guys out. Get a microphone and a headset down here and you tell me who you want and I'll get them on the air. So we said we wanted to have Bobby Wood Jr. on. So the team comes off the field and Bobby Wood Jr. comes on and he's just as polite as everybody knows he is now. And we're talking going on and on. Well, the Royals start rallying and getting a lot of guys on base with one or two pitches and the inning is moving very quickly. And I don't remember if it was Steve Stewart or me. We were right in the middle of asking him a question. And in typical Bobby Wood Jr., being polite, he says, excuse me, sir, I'm going to have to get off because I'm on deck. I'm sure that recording is out there somewhere. But But other than that, I mean, you can have, you know, you can have uninterrupted conversations with another starting pitcher or the designated hitter or somebody like that, because the sport lends itself. And I know in the All-Star game, they've had players mic'd up when they're on the field. And there is a lot of standing around in baseball because there isn't constant action, but there's a lot of thought going on. There's a lot of anticipation going on. And so if they could find a way, you know, where you mic an infielder or an outfielder and they're telling you what they have to think about right now, who's at the plate, who's on base, what's the score, who's coming up, you know, who the cutoff man is, whatever. Anything that we can do to bring the fans closer to the inside of the game, the better.
Yep. Great stuff, Ryan. Enjoy your last couple days here on this road trip in California. I know it probably feels a little bit like home for you. You're near the ocean. I think maybe you go for a little walk on the beach today before tonight's game and enjoy. Do you catch up with old friends and stuff when you're back in L.A.?
I have a couple buddies from junior high school, and you can think about how far back that was. They're going to come to the game tonight, and I haven't seen them for a long time. So as time's gone on and we've gotten married and had kids, and I'm in Anaheim. I'm not in Los Angeles. I don't get a chance to see him very often. But I'll get to see a couple of junior high school buddies at the game.
Good for you.
Game tonight.
Good for you. Yeah. Enjoy, and let's go get a couple. All right.
All right. Good to talk with you, Kevin.
Thank you, Ryan. He is Ryan LaFever. So kind to spend some time with us talking about all those great stories growing up in California around Major League Baseball. Right here on Kevin Keatsman Has Issues.
Thanks for listening to Kevin Keatsman Has Issues, presented by Roberts Robinson Chevrolet Buick GMC. To get exclusive patrons-only podcasts, receive a weekly newsletter, and attend in-person patrons-only parties, visit kkhasissues.com and become a patron today. This has been a production of Crooked Tail Media Incorporated.